A hot summer day is overrated, yet a frigid winter leaves me aggravated. So I've settled on an easy yet firm position. My favorites are the seasons. We're in transition. Welcome, everybody, to Spectrum West, where the arts and culture of West Wisconsin shines and shouts. I'm Al Ross, and this week you're going to meet Philip Gully. You may have read some of his work. I did, but I did not know the writer, and he's a fun guy to get to know. His books, which include autobiographical humor, a popular series of novels, and even some theology, are the result of his calling and his diverse interests, all defining why what he writes is so universally enjoyable. I contacted him to talk about Chautauquas, but one simply cannot touch just one subject when Phil Gully's on the other end of the line. Catherine Thomas is here. She's heard some news about libraries and their plans to slowly transition toward whatever is normal these days. Issa Small is Programming and Communications Services Manager at the L.E. Phillips Library in Eau Claire. She has a lot of what we need to know. And let's get the show on the road right here. Alyssa Sigon is the Director of Education at PBS Wisconsin, formerly called Wisconsin Public Television. With WPR, it makes up the entity known as WPM, Wisconsin Public Media. Talk about a place where the last 4 months have turned what they do into an even more vital resource. It's a busy place. It's a morphing place, transforming itself as needed, while COVID-19 continues to do a number on all of us. I spoke with Alyssa by phone earlier in the week. One of the lines I read in something recently received via email says, "The PBS Wisconsin Education Team creates and curates educational resources while connecting with Wisconsin's most valuable resource, teachers." Now, I can't think of a group of people who have had to be more flexible or more creative during the last, let's say, 4 months than teachers. And I can't think of anyone whose role has become more important than ever during that time than PBS Wisconsin. It has to be tiring and exhilarating at the same time.
That is a perfect way to put it, Al. I don't think anyone can look at the last couple of months and doubt the importance and relevance and value of educators. It has just been amazing to witness the care and diligence that teachers all over the state and the country have put into maintaining any sense of connection, continuity, and support for learners and their families. I can't say enough to honor what they have been doing.
You know, we've had a lot of tributes to what they call frontline workers. Teachers, are they frontline workers?
Well, if you're asking me, I would say yes. Many people really do come under that category of frontline and essential workers. We all are connected and interdependent on one another. The first or second week children were home, somebody posting on social media, "Teachers should make $1 million a year." You know, I think of the many lessons that we're all learning right now, I hope that one of them is that recognition of how much value and respect we should really have for the profession of education.
I agree. Let's, if you don't mind, talk a bit about the makeup of PBS Wisconsin Education. What were the biggies?
Well, Al, if I could go back in time to one meeting in Wisconsin public media history, the meeting that I would like to go to is the one in which a producer pitched a radio show called Let's Draw.
There you go.
Teaching children how to draw over the radio. I really want to know, was that idea met with, "That's crazy, how can you teach drawing over the radio?" Did they say, hey, it's the spirit of experimentation and innovation, go for it, see what happens? I would love to know how hard or easy it was to get that show through. And I love talking to people around Wisconsin who remember listening to those, especially the stories from listeners who grew up attending one-room schools, able to listen to content like Let's Sing and Let's Draw and... is it Ranger Mac? Was that one of the shows? And School of the Air. So there's this wonderful legacy of public media using technology to meet needs in education.
Was education the foundation of public broadcasting? Is that why it started?
As I understand it, public broadcasting was really built to educate and inspire learners of all ages. I think we're still striving to uphold and fulfill that today, being exposed to new ideas. And for me and for my department, that is really focused on serving learners and educators. And I use the term educators broadly. I believe that parents can be educators. Librarians can be educators. There are many formal and informal educators that develop learners' growth and help them thrive in the world.
Is there a year that it all began, the PBS education aspect, concept?
You know, it's actually kind of hard to pinpoint a single year because we did start out talking about how education was presented through Wisconsin Public Radio, and then my impression is that it sort of dovetailed and overlapped with the birth of television and experimenting and creating content like The Friendly Giant in the 50s. And then the networks grew. The PBS system came to be programs like The Children's Corner leading into Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Sesame Street. And I grew up with a teacher wheeling a cart into the classroom with a television and a VCR. They would pop in a VHS tape, probably recorded through an overnight broadcast, like Swim Good Body. Even in high school, I remember watching The Power of Myth with Bill Moyers and Joseph Campbell in an art class. So teachers have been finding ways to integrate that broadcast educational content. Then the internet was born in Wisconsin. Public media pivoted again, creating educational media that could be accessed and used in the classroom online. And now with current situation, the concept of equity and access that's been so inherent to the mission of public media and has presented that new opportunity of, oh my goodness, in a time when we're sending learners home and trying to figure out how to continue to support their learning, and there's not equitable access to broadband and to devices, all of a sudden the television and radio have new relevance that we thought had sort of gone away in education because of the internet. But the reliability of internet access in school buildings doesn't always match in homes. And that was why we worked together with the Department of Public Instruction and our colleagues in Duluth and in Milwaukee to launch the at-home learning schedule that put together content beyond that PBS Kids 2 to 8-year-old age range, curating programs like Nova and Nature and History Detectives that could provide some high-quality learning content for students for who maybe an antenna is their best way of receiving media. This is a time that we may not have predicted or maybe forgotten in a way how important it is that public media has focused on that access issue and the ability for everyone, no matter where you are, to be able to connect with that content. And really, PBS Kids for a long time has been America's largest classroom.
Sure. On the phone with Alyssa Segong. She's Director of Education at PBS Wisconsin. So the intent, is it to complement the in-school experience? And to do that, you have to be aware of what's being taught in schools.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm guessing the PBS Wisconsin model includes a board that directs and oversees content, and that board contains actual in-school educators. You brought up Department of Public Instruction a bit earlier. What kind of mandates are you under from state or national education administrations?
That's an interesting question. We don't have a board exactly as you've described it. We approach creating content in a way that aims to be very responsive and engaged with lots of stakeholders, like you've mentioned. Each new project begins at the concepting stage by connecting multiple stakeholders. And so that might look like, for example, with a project such as Wisconsin First Nations, that's a website we created in collaboration with the American Indian Studies Department at the Department of Public Instruction and with colleagues at UW-Madison School of Education and with educators who were working to teach in effort to fulfill the spirit of Act 31, teaching the cultural, the sovereignty, and information about our tribal nations in Wisconsin and an awareness that there was a lack of resources there. So that's a very large initiative that brings together a lot of content and resources. But the other stakeholder that is extremely important in any of this is the learner and the student. And so we work with any new content not only to ideate and concept with the people who are working the most closely with students, and then also to bring in student voices to make sure that we're doing something that we call play testing at different phases in the project. A really easy to understand example of that is when we created a video game called Joe Wilder and the Capital Case, which helps support students learning historical inquiry skills and learning how to think like a historian and uncover clues, use critical thinking skills in the context of the Wisconsin State Capitol to learn about major events in our state history. And so at multiple points in the development of that game, the teachers who worked with us on concepting were bringing early versions into their classroom for their students to test and provide feedback. Was it achieving the learning goals that we set out to fulfill? Yes, keep going. No, bring it back and retool it. Yeah. Everything from the art to the dialogue and everything in between, it affects that experience.
And thanks for hitting on that, because that was my next area of inquiry, which was evaluation. Let's fast forward to today's world. You have webinars, Educator Connection Live. There is a, but I'm guessing there's many of them, teacher Facebook groups.
There are many teacher Facebook groups, and we also host a teacher Facebook group.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and if one goes to your website, you find tabs that say early childhood, classroom education, which is K through 12, and also, I think one thing we might forget about, community education, sometimes labeled continuing education, possibly. There is, Alyssa, a line in a release I read that resonates and opens the floodgates of curiosity for me. Here's that line: strategies for building culturally relevant schools in a post-COVID-19 world. Even though educators teach, they're also good at learning, and I have to believe that you've learned quite a bit that will be valuable in that post-COVID-19 world, something that simply can't become post quick enough. Is that right?
Absolutely. One of the things that drew me to education in the first place is that sense of lifelong curiosity and interest in learning. And that, among all of the broad things that you just outlined, Al, curiosity is the through line. Educators are the most curious people. They want to keep learning and growing because they're so relentless in their ambition to provide the best opportunities to their students. So we really follow their lead. And the webinar that you mentioned was presented by Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings. She is the expert in culturally relevant strategies in the classroom. We learn so much from her. That was actually one of our most popular webinars, the whole series of which our engagement team is normally traveling around the state, presenting at conferences or doing in-service workshops for teachers. And just like everybody else, they had to figure out how to reinvent that in a virtual environment. We talked at the beginning about how busy teachers are and how hard they've worked to pivot and reimagine how they could teach in a virtual setting. It's been amazing how they've still made time to invest in their own professional learning by connecting with other educators and attending webinars to get advice, new ideas. Our engagement team is so good at listening deeply to what teachers are asking for, presenting content, finding expert voices, other educators to facilitate that learning and conversations.
Now, you used past tense when you were talking about the webinar. Obviously, I missed something. Do you have more of that stuff coming down the pike?
We do, yes. The one that you had mentioned was at the end of June.
Okay.
But we're continuing to present new content throughout the summer and keep our events page up to date, as well as we have a e-newsletter specifically for educators.
Okay, so now there are parents in our audience, even grandparents, who say, you know what, I got to access more of this stuff. I've heard about it. I just haven't delved into it deeply enough. How do they do that?
I would direct parents or grandparents or caregivers of children 8 and younger to pbswisconsin.org/family resources for anybody looking to explore and play and learn with children in their care this summer, including Radio for Kids on WPR Fridays at 8 a.m. The Ideas Network hosts a really wonderful show geared towards children. If you're looking for content to support summer learning for children in older grades, 3rd through 12th grade, I'd suggest parents start at pbswisconsineducation.org, and there you'll find resources created by and with and for Wisconsin. It'll also lead you to a vast repository of PBS learning media for every grade and subject that you can imagine, created by our team and created by education departments at PBS stations around the country.
And within that wonderful explanation, you use the word support. People can do that monetarily and other ways as well. Alyssa Sagong, thank you so much. Keep up the great work. We have talked with a lot of people about how we're all going to be different and probably a lot stronger when all of this stuff goes away.
I think we have a real opportunity, Al, to continue the work of adapting and working to make sure that all of our kids have equitable access to high quality resources and learning experiences.
Amen. Thanks for spending time on the phone with me.
I really appreciate the opportunity. It was nice to talk with you today.
To repeat those websites that Alyssa gave us, pbswisconsin.org/family resources and pbswisconsineducation.org. There you go. Coming up on Spectrum West, we'll say hello to Philip Gully, and you'll learn why knowing what he does and partaking of it can add some pleasant moments to your life. Next, a Catherine Thomas conversation. You're listening to Spectrum West on WPR. Thank you so much for doing so. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Charter Bank, a locally owned community bank, now offering checking account options. Charter Bank is dedicated to being invested in the community, customers, and employees. More information is at charterbank.bank. The libraries of Western Wisconsin are places people turn to for not only information they can count on, but living, breathing people, instead of the living, sometimes fire-breathing internet, who make the adjustments and the system work for you. Libraries have been at the heart of cities' anatomies for generations, and they continue in that capacity. Catherine Thomas talked with one particular librarian, and her guest this week is Issa Small from the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire.
We're talking today because there's some big news. The Eau Claire Public Library is open. Sort of.
Sort of, yes.
What does that mean?
Well, we are continuing our old pickup, so that's like a curbside service that's happening in the lower level of the library. And just last week, we started accepting in-person appointments at the library. So we are allowing up to 15 customers into the library for hour slots throughout the day. And they are divided up into appointments to come in and browse and look for items or to use the library computer.
And there are some hours for at-risk people, too. Yes?
Wednesday morning, the first 2 hours of the day are reserved for at-risk customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So that just started on, I think, last Wednesday, was it?
Yep. Just barely, not even quite a week yet.
How's it been going so far?
It has been going really well. Everyone has been great. They've been very excited to be back in the library. They have been maintaining social distancing and wearing their masks. And it's been fantastic to see people back in the library and checking out books again.
Exactly. It's for the public, without any public.
Yeah, right.
Strange. Well, you mentioned masks. Is that a requirement for people in the library?
Yes, all our staff are wearing masks, and we ask anyone who is able to wear a mask to do so.
Are there any other requirements? So I'm going to come for my appointment. What should I expect when I'm there?
Awesome. We ask that folks wear masks. We encourage them to use hand sanitizer when they come in and when they leave. As they're walking around and picking up materials, if there's something they've had with them for a little while, they decide not to take it home, we ask them just to put it on a cart so that we can quarantine those materials. And other than that, it's really just checking in, checking out so that we know who's in the building.
Yeah, I wondered about the touching things. You know, you got people wandering around first floor, second floor of the library, looking at all the books and touching things. And I wasn't sure if you would clean things or you'd keep an eye on people to see what they get their hands on or how that works. What's the cleaning procedure?
The cleaning procedure is essentially what it has been. Our big focus is on quarantining material. So the things that people have picked up, had, you know, near their face, you know, as they're looking through a book or something, we just ask that they put those on a shelf for us to quarantine. So those will be set aside for 72 hours before they go back on the shelf.
Yeah.
And then as far as, you know, non-material related cleaning, of course, that is, we have tons of sanitizer everywhere. We have sanitizing wipes. You know, our custodians, as always, are doing a great job of keeping the library clean. We're definitely trying to make everything as clean and healthy and safe as possible.
How long did it take to equip the library with the necessary? I haven't been in there, but mm-hmm. Is there plexiglass, that kind of thing that needed some planning beforehand?
So, you know, we do have staff at all of our public service desks. So we have, you know, some plexiglass barriers for them. And then as we welcome people into the library, we've got a desk with a plexiglass station there. We've got the little stickers on the ground to help encourage social distancing. And then, of course, tons and tons of signage so that, you know, folks know what things may or may not be available right now.
Mm-hmm. And did we talk about the length of the appointments yet? I don't think we got to that. So if I want to
browse. I mentioned it just briefly. It's 1 hour appointments for browsing, and then computers are 75-minute appointments.
Gotcha. Well, Issa Small is a programming and communication services manager at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. She joins us today to talk about the library's new in-person appointments and a couple other library services. You mentioned curbside earlier. That's something I've done, and I've got an appointment today to do it. Very exciting. How has that been going?
It's been going really well. You know, when we first opened up, we were just doing one appointment every 10 minutes, and that quickly became not enough. We had literally hundreds of folks trying to make appointments that we had to figure out how to do. So we made some pretty big changes down there, and that lower level what used to be the lower level parking area is now dedicated just to curbside so that we can allow that much traffic down there. Now we're able to do, we've quadrupled how many appointments we can take at a time with that, and it's going really well.
Wow, that is so amazing. Library staff, they're probably doing some different things than they would do under normal circumstances. What's it been like to reposition the staff?
It's been the same all over, I suppose. Nothing really is the same as it was before. So in that way, it's kind of an opportunity to look at everything fresh. So I think that for the most part, our staff have been super excited to get back into the library, to be able to be helping customers. And most of what we're doing, we're making up, right? I mean, none of us that work at the library have been through a pandemic before, so we don't have policies and procedures and guidelines for that. So we're kind of making it up as we go, doing the best we can. And things change a little bit day to day, so they're getting a little better, but it is a little bit to keep up on, you know. what do I need to know today? But our staff have been fantastic and go with the flow, and our focus is on health and safety first and excellent customer service. So those are two, you know, kind of guideposts that we use to make any decisions that we need to.
Great. Well, on that note, I was looking on the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction website, and I mm-hmm. think they help oversee all the public libraries in the state.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
And they had some data from past years for library attendance, use of services, and et cetera. So if you don't mind, I'd like to share some of those numbers so we get a sense of how well used our library is.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So the most recent report from the Department of Public Instruction was from 2017 that I could find, and it says the Eau Claire Public Library in 2017 had over 40,000 registered borrowers, 78,000 reference transactions, 420,000 library visits, and about 49,000 computer uses. And 28,000 people, roughly, attended about 766 library programs in that year alone. Those numbers are huge. I never would have guessed any of those numbers.
Yeah.
So clearly the library is, our community really depends on the library. But
yeah.
With the pandemic and all the changes, I mean, for the sake of public safety, the library is pretty different now than mm-hmm. than it was in 2017 or even just earlier this year. And I'm going to share a quote now from the director of the Altoona Library, Allison Jones. She talked with the Leader Telegram last week. "We're trying to find the intersection between accessibility and responsibility when deciding how or when to open the library." So how does the Eau Claire Public Library find that intersection?
I think we find it day by day and little by little. Those are definitely the questions that we're asking ourselves as we make each decision. And I think one thing that we've done with some help from DPI is kind of prioritize which services do we think our community needs the most right now, and how can we make those happen? So for right now, it's checking out materials and having access to internet computers, because there are a lot of folks who may need to apply for unemployment. They may need, you know, other services that are, you know, apply for jobs, you know, and most of those you can only do online now. So if you don't have internet, then you're not able to do that. So eventually it will be in-person programs and such, but certainly that's a ways off for us.
Right, but there are a lot of online and computer services. I just figured out last night I can use Ancestry.com for free with my library card.
You can.
I had no idea. And also, I know the library has a pretty active Facebook page. So what are the online services available through the library for people at home?
Yeah, so we're still doing our summer library program, both for kids, teens, as well as adults. And so that has all moved digital this year. We still have paper records if that's how you prefer to keep track of it. And that, of course, just encourages everybody to be reading throughout the summer. And then for the kids, there's special programming that goes along with that, and that has all gone online. So that is able to be accessed via Facebook and our YouTube channel as well. So the presenters and the programs that would normally be happening in person on Wednesdays and Thursdays have just kind of change the format that they're doing. And we're also doing online story time, which has been super incredibly very, very well received. I know my 3-year-old, wants to come home and watch Storytime instead of Frozen or Onward, and that is, that's wonderful for me.
Yeah, pretty high compliment from a kid there. Awesome.
Yep.
So we're in phase one of the reopening of the library, and the in-person mm-hmm. appointments are part of that phase one. I don't want to get too excited about phase two, but I'm kind of excited about it. What might happen in phase two?
I think if we're looking at turning up the dial, we started very small with the number of people. I mean, we're certainly well below what the City County Health Department tells us we should be having for a building of our size. I think it will be first increasing the number of people using the same type of in-person appointments. I'm not for sure on that. I mean, certainly everything right now is changing day by day. Right now, we really just started this last week. We're trying to make sure that we've got our process and procedure down for this step because the management team has been kind of staffing that door just to see what happens this first week. The next step internally for us is now training other staff to be able to do that. So we've got some internal things to work on with phase one.
Well, other things happening in phases, the library's expansion plan through the Story Builder campaign. How is that going? I imagine it's been affected by the pandemic.
It has. In a way, I think that we have a lot of questions about, like, is it still happening? And the answer is yes. The answer is yes. The building needs updates. And we already have a huge commitment from the City of Eau Claire, and we are moving forward with the project in early spring of 2021. So it's moving ahead regardless of where the campaign is at. But we've actually had really nice-sized gifts coming in for the campaign, even through this pandemic, because people recognize that, you know, in a time of crisis, public libraries are a great place to invest because we will be here, you know, even if it's in limited services for now, we're still continuing to serve our community and find out what they need to help get them through this crisis and, you know, find those resources or refer them.
Issa Small is the Programming and Communication Services Manager at Eau Claire's L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library. The library is now offering in-person services by appointment, and curbside pickup is going strong, too. You can find more information at ecpubliclibrary.info. Issa Small, thanks so much. I appreciate the time. I'm so grateful for the library and all the work that you do and everyone else there as well.
Thank you so much.
Other libraries in our region are also at work offering curbside pickup by appointment. Some are open with restrictions. Included in that list are public libraries in Augusta, Hudson, Menominee, and Pepin. Wherever you are, check with your library, and it does belong to you for updates and available services. Thanks, Catherine. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. First big event for the Pioneer Village Museum in Cameron is going to be held this weekend during Heritage Days. There's ample room for social distancing on the spacious grounds, and the Pioneer Village grounds and staff are following best practices, okay? PioneerVillageMuseum.org is the website to go for more on that stuff. Well, it started with a leisurely Sunday morning of reading accumulated periodicals. The article containing a brief history of Chautauquas looked interesting, and it was. Turns out the writer's also quite remarkable. Let's see, with Big Top Chautauqua, a jewel in Wisconsin's crown, we can talk about the article a bit, and in the process, find out more about the author. Well, it turned out to be a gathering July snowball. So what follows is a communications casserole, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, in which you'll meet Philip Gully, a regular Saturday Evening Post columnist and author, and that's just the beginning. I called Danville, Indiana, 2 days ago to get the snowball rolling. He writes a column called The Lighter Side in the Saturday Evening Post. He's written several. Actually, I think he's attained the label many books. He's a speaker, a pastor at an Indiana Quaker gathering, and he loves to have and ride motorcycles, among other things. I think he's a true Renaissance man. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Philip Gully.
Good to be here.
Now, you and I are going to talk about the historic Chautauqua phenomenon, But by way of a who the heck is Philip Gulley intro, and I have to admit I wasn't prepared for this can of worms. I don't know about others out there in our audience, but these old eyes have been opened in kind of several ways, not the least of which is up until this point in my life, I don't believe I ever thought about what it meant to be a Quaker. And I have to say, you don't look at all like the guy in the oatmeal box. I'm sure you get that. You get that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
I can say my uninformed impression seems to have been not only shallow, but completely and undeniably all wrong, because it included exclusion, some pompous prim and proper, a healthy helping of holier than thou, and for some flavor, a tablespoon of some fire and brimstone, whereas Quakerism appears to be the thinking person's religion. Tell me the Cliff's Notes definition of the religious society of friends.
Well, all of those things that you mentioned were probably accurate at one time. We were a religious movement that began in England around 1649, rebelling against kind of the established religion of the day, and then we became the established religion of the day. And like all religious movements, changed over time and became affluent, and as I said, Quakers went out to do good and did very well. And now it is a shadow of its former self numerically. I think it's accurate to say there are more Baptists in Birmingham than there are Quakers in the world.
Hmm.
But it centers around what we call the testimonies, simplicity, peace, integrity, community, and equality.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be that the average Quaker was a businessman in Philadelphia, but now the average Quaker lives in Kenya, where most of our growth this past century has happened.
Hmm.
But there are pockets of Quakerism around the U.S. I know we have a meeting in Madison, Wisconsin.
I do believe there's a meeting in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, too, where I am sitting.
Might be.
So cool. You are the pastor of the Fairfield Friends meeting in Camby, Indiana. So you were raised Catholic. When and where did Quakerism enter your life?
The town where I grew up and where I still live was founded by Quakers in the 1820s.
Okay.
We'd moved up from North Carolina. And one day when I was 17 years old, I received on my front porch, and our neighbors were Quakers, and I saw carload after carload of attractive young Quaker teenage girls pull up for their Sunday night youth group meeting, and I felt called by God to become a Quaker.
There you go.
And so I did.
It's not good to not heed that call. One more question about Quakerism. I'm wondering about activism. With all the stuff that's going on in America today, the turning point that we seem to be at, how do Quakers affect, or do they want to affect, change in a physical way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's always been part and parcel of the Quaker faith. It's what brought us, the forerunners at my own meeting, up to Indiana. We were escaping the slave culture and didn't want to be economically tied and live in communities where that was the economic driver, and so moved up to Indiana in the 1820s.
Hmm.
Today, that means if you are at a Quaker meeting, you likely participate in activities and efforts for inclusion for all, and that is part and parcel of what it means to be a Quaker.
On the phone with Philip Gulley, he's an author, a humorist, a pastor, and I have to let you know, he's a biker, folks. The article I read is called Adventures of the Mind. It was in the July and August edition of the Saturday Evening Post. It's all about the Chautauqua movement and concept. There's some history there, and we'll get onto that in a second. But having established in our first few minutes that Philip Gulley is an okay guy with a good head on his shoulders and a healthy perspective, it's no wonder that he's such a good and popular writer. Your work travels paths similar to Bill Bryson, Garrison Keillor, Thurber. You were a finalist in an award that's named after him, and more. Can I call you Phil?
Sure.
When did you realize, Phil, or who told you that you had a knack for telling stories?
You know, that happened after I became a pastor. I've been pastoring now for 36 years, and when I first started having to deliver weekly sermons, I wasn't a particularly gifted speaker. So began taking classes homiletics and discerned that those pastors that I enjoyed hearing and listening to were at their heart storytellers. I came from a small town in a big old house with a front porch, so had met numerous storytellers over my life, including both my parents and family members. So I just began to do what they always did, and I found that people seemed to resonate with that.
Well, storytelling on paper is a little different than storytelling in front of a big crowd, and you're good on paper. So I haven't heard you in front of a crowd, but you're dang good on paper.
Well, I enjoy it. I enjoy writing.
You're actually listed by one review that I read as a master storyteller. That takes a bit of doing to get that label.
Well, or a really good publicist.
Included in your stable of books, the I Love You, Miss Huddleston and Other Inappropriate Longings of My Indiana Childhood is a book that I, after reading about it this weekend, ordered. Can't wait for it to be delivered.
Well, I hope you enjoy it.
The Harmony series is a group of novels. Porch Talk, as you said, you had the big front porch tales. How much of what you write is entertainment and how much of it is preaching in humorists' clothing?
Well, I always try to use humor no matter what I'm writing. Some of my books are distinctly theological. If grace is true, if God is love, if the church were Christian, even though you'll find them on the theology shelf when you go into a bookstore, I try to use a lighter touch. I think one of the sad things about religion is that those who practice it tend to take themselves a bit too seriously, and something suffers in the process. Even when I'm writing about what I think are important things, I try to do it with a light touch.
Let's get on to the Chautauqua concept. You, for that article that I read in the Saturday Evening Post, obviously did a bunch of research, although you have spoken at a few, and so you might have just known that innately as you became involved. Wisconsin recognizes the word Chautauqua. We have the very popular Big Top Chautauqua way up north, fairly famous in its own right. The piece I read in the July-August Post is titled Adventures of the Mind, which I'm guessing is your definition of what maybe the Chautauqua experience is.
Yeah. Theodore Roosevelt called it the most American of institutions. This was a movement that swept America in the late 1800s, well into the 1920s. Even the little town where I live was on the circuit. Every summer, for 2 weeks, a group of lecturers, musicians, artists, singers would come and pitch a tent and entertain and educate the townspeople.
The two guys who got it rolling, Lewis Miller and John Vincent, they had, at the beginning, Christianity in mind. Not that Chautauquas would preach it necessarily, but simply providing experiences that would add to the well-roundedness of Christians. Is that a fair definition?
It was coupled with the emerging trend of Sunday schools. The Sunday school movement had just started, and those two men were deeply concerned about the quality of education happening in the Sunday school movement, and so started the Chautauqua in an effort to train and teach Sunday school teachers. You've ever been to a boring Sunday school class, you'll know why they were concerned about that. So it was an effort to really increase the ability of folks who taught Sunday school.
Yeah, but I'm guessing that they had no idea of the impending popularity of these. I mean, they turned out to be the Barnum and Bailey of Christianity.
Oh, my gosh. I think at its height, 1 out of every 4 Americans attended the Chautauqua.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite a movement.
You've spoken at a Chautauqua or 2 or 3. Actually, a Chautauqua might be, speaking at one, might be the pursuit of any speaker who deems himself or herself worth his salt.
I tell you, they're a lot of fun to speak at. I think I've spoken at maybe 8 of them or so now. I've kind of lost count. But they're enjoyable because the average participant is there to learn, is there to grow, and so you've got a ready-made audience.
Did you feel like you had to be a certain kind of person in front of that particular audience? Did you feel like they had an expectation?
You know, that's the interesting thing about Chautauquas. They attract such a variety of philosophical points of view that it really works best when you're just yourself. There's just an eagerness to learn, which I find refreshing.
So as you're standing up there, you can literally feel the open minds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And when I do it, I think of all the people who've, you know, stood there before me. Martin Luther King, Helen Keller, FDR, all of these people in history. I just couldn't help but think of all the other hands that had rested on that podium.
Mm-hmm. The original place, you know, in New York State on the lake, is that still going? Is it a museum? What
oh,
is it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, it's still going.
Oh, it is.
Thousands of people. I spoke there last year during an afternoon event, and there were probably 600 people at just that afternoon event. Hmm. If I had spoken there on Sunday morning, there would have been 4,000 to 5,000 people.
Oh, so you were the warm-up act.
I was the warm-up act.
Attaboy.
And I was delighted to be the warm-up act.
Good for you.
It was fun.
Chautauquas are noted for being kind of creative smorgasbords. What are you hearing and seeing from these spaces and places in the face of COVID-19 and people not wanting to get together? What are Chautauquas doing?
Unfortunately, because of COVID, most of the Chautauquas that I know about do not have programming this year, this summer. Now, because they are residential in nature, people are certainly allowed to their cottages, where they often will spend the entire summer. But the gatherings themselves, the concerts, the lectures, have been canceled.
You know, I was going to obviously say, aren't they doing anything on video? But the whole premise of a Chautauqua is the audience.
You really need to be there for the give and take, for the, sure. the conversations, for the porch meetings afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I've not found any way to replicate that.
So it just wouldn't be the same.
Wouldn't be the same.
All right, let's go back to your writing for a second. In your Saturday Evening Post lighter side columns, I think I've read a bunch of them. I subscribe. I guess I wasn't reading Philip Gully as the author. I think I just enjoyed them. But now I know the guy. I do save these somewhere along the line after I'm gone. Someone's going to want to read them, so I'm saving them. I went back a few times, and I saw one about cows. I saw another one about frozen foods. I saw one about fried chicken. Where does that stuff come from? Where do those subjects come in Phil Gully's life?
Well, fried chicken ranks right up there with my religion, so.
It is almost religious in itself, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah. So those are all personal experiences?
Or? Oh, yeah. Keeping my eyes open, kind of sitting on my own peculiar bench and watching the world pass by. And my sons provide me with material. I can always find something to write about.
I suggest to everybody in our audience that they get to know Phil Gully better, and if nothing else, go online and read some of your stuff. Saturday Evening Post has a good website. I have to say in concluding that my weekend, this past weekend, was what I'm calling a gully washer. I am hooked, and I'm looking forward to reading more of your work. And thank you so much for joining our meeting of public radio friends. Philip Gully,
well,
all the best.
Thank you for having me on. I sure appreciate it.
Philip Gully, if nothing else, pick up some of what he's written. It'll brighten your day, and who doesn't need that right about now? He's got a website, Philip Gully, that's GULLEY.com. Coming up next week, a special garden, a distinctive music school, the art of writing history as we live and breathe, and more. Thanks to Dean, Kate, Catherine, and Jim. Live safe and smart. And what do you say we get together again next week, huh? For now, let's return to that list of top 50 songs that can make you feel better during the pandemic, and in this case, less worried about what's going on around us. From 1988, Mr. Bobby McFerrin. What were you doing in 1988? If it's good, that might be something to think about when you feel yourself getting overwhelmed. Hmm? See ya next week.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry.
be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Got no place to lay your head. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry, be happy. The landlord say your rent is late. He may have to litigate. Don't worry, be happy.
Look at me, I'm happy. Don't worry, be happy. Hey, I give you my phone number. When you worry, call me. I make you happy.